You're listening to the We Are Libertarians Podcast Network. Find all of our shows at wearelibertarians.com.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture, and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Thanks so much for joining me today. I am excited about my conversation today with Caleb Franz, who is a contributor. He's a host here on the We Are Libertarians Podcast Network, host of Profiles in Liberty, which you can go check out in your podcast app. And his experience doing that podcast led to him writing a book about John Rankin, who is really the father of the abolitionist movement here in America. And his story is one that encourages us to speak truth into contentious issues, have courage while talking about those issues, and even when there are very adverse conditions and even physical violence. Not that many of us face physical violence when talking about issues today. Not really anything compares to slavery in our day and time, thankfully. But John Rankin had the courage to stand up and say that we need to abolish this. We need this to end, and he did it in a very interesting way. What is it? Find out here next on The Chris Spangle Show. Caleb Franz, thanks so much for being here.
It's been a long time.
I know. Chris, how long has it been since we talk all the time offline, but when's the last time you were on the show? Do you know?
Oh, probably 2 or 3 years ago at this point.
Yeah, so you did Profiles in Liberty. You may still be doing it. I don't know what you're doing in the secret of your own home, but one of the hosts here on the network, and I think it's so cool that you've written a book, which we're going to talk about, but give us some retrospective or maybe a preview of Profiles in Liberty. I know you did that podcast for 2 seasons, and what impact did it have on you?
I would say that Profiles was a very impactful show. The door is always open to it, but it certainly directly led to the production of this book that I have currently written. And I'm putting on the final touches now. It's coming out in October 15th. It's called The Conductor. And I can confidently say that everything that we put together with Wall, with Profiles in Liberty, that had a direct impact on the trajectory of that book.
Yeah, so if you haven't listened to the show, it's evergreen. So it's not like you were talking about like the war in Russia in 2014. You're talking about what on Profiles in Liberty that people can still go check out all the episodes that you did.
Yeah, season one, I did a breakdown and some forgotten stories or overlooked stories on the lives of the signers of the Declaration of Independence. And that one was a lot of fun. It was bread and butter stuff for me. So it was really fun to do some deep dives into some people that I had long admired, but also some people that I never really had the opportunity to look into too much until that project. And then season two, that's I think really where a lot of the inspiration for this book came from, was all about, especially in the first half of season two, was all about these abolitionist figures who went out. And I think part of the tagline for that season was, these were the people who fulfilled the promise of 1776, fulfilled the promise of the Declaration of Independence. And we had people like Frederick Douglass, for example, well-known people on that sort of thing, but also some lesser well-known people like William Still or Mum Bett, people that aren't household names by any stretch of the imagination. And that kind of opened up a few doors for me because I had wanted to write history. I had always wanted to do books or tell stories in that format. And it helped me realize that there were so many stories just in our backyards that have this tremendous impact on the trajectory of the country and influence all these people that are household names to so many of us. And these people that had that impact, they're forgotten about. They've been lost to history. So I wanted to identify that. And I fortunately, as we'll get in here, I found one quite literally in my backyard that's had a much bigger impact than even I had realized until I started getting into it.
One of the purposes of the show is really to highlight how a single individual can change so much. Mm-hmm. And when you study history, you really start to see that one person can impact so many different things, right? Like the example I always use is Charles Dickens, who basically invented Christmas as we know it. And so much of what in terms of Christmas is a blend of 20% Charles Dickens, 20% Germans, and 60% markers from the 1920s, right? But you're talking about a half a dozen people that really like shape our Christmas tradition five generations later, right? And I think Rankin, who we'll be talking about today, is one of those great examples of here's a guy who just wrote some letters and then got involved in a few organizational things and helped abolish slavery in America by pricking its conscience. I think it's such a fantastic story, but as you work through those stories, how often did you find that same thing that an individual, maybe I'm wrong, but how often do you see an individual taking some action on the local level that eventually led to bigger things 2-3 generations later?
Yeah, it's everywhere. The more I dug into this story in the book, as well as obviously all the stories and profiles, the more I realized that most of American history is actually like that. It's not like there are these, we have this image of you have your George Washingtons and your Abraham Lincolns, people who seemed almost from birth predestined to lead these extraordinary lives. And there might be some truth to that, but most of history, it's not your George Washingtons. It's not your Abraham Lincolns or Thomas Jeffersons. It's people like John Rankin who are in our backyards, who are just living their lives, and they're ordinary people who eventually decide that they need to stand up and do something about some injustice that they're seeing out in the world. And it's the courage of ordinary people like that that ultimately makes the difference.
So let's talk about John Rankin. How did you decide to write a book about an obscure guy that nobody's ever heard of from the 1820s? Where did you stumble upon John Rankin? And tell us a little, give us the scope of your book. Let's start there, and then we'll talk about the time and the man.
Yeah. So this was a really interesting project because I had known about John Rankin from a young age, because he had died in the hometown that I grew up in. And I knew that he had I knew he was an abolitionist. I knew that he had an influence on the founder of the town that I grew up in Ironton, Ohio. His name was John Campbell, because John was a very prominent name in the 1800s that everyone just gave to all their kids. But I didn't really know the story. I knew that he came from Ripley, Ohio, not too far away from where I grew up in Ironton. And he was an abolitionist and he was a reverend. And that was about the extent of it. When I was reading The Pioneers that we've spoken about often offline, I had this light bulb moment about how there's so much of American history, so much of the impact and the trajectory that everything after it took place, after the revolution took place right in the cradle of the Ohio River and where the Northwest Ordinance took place in Ohio, Indiana, and Illinois, and so forth. And that kind of reminded me of the story of John Rankin and how that's yet another example of someone who's right there in my backyard. And no one has ever really heard of this guy. No one ever really thinks about him as this prominent figure. The more research that I did into his life and into his story, I was blown away. I was completely dumbfounded as to why he's been so lost to history. He had a direct influence on people like William Lloyd Garrison, Harriet Beecher Stowe, an indirect influence to people like Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln, obviously. He laid the foundation for the entire abolitionist movement through a series of letters that he wrote to his brother in 1824. His brother had recently written to John, catching up, letting him know how he had been. And John, eager to hear from his family, was very excited until he read that his brother Thomas had purchased slaves. And this kind of broke him down and made him realize that if his own flesh and blood, and they grew up in an abolitionist household, an anti-slavery family, they were Presbyterians, they had a deep-seated religious opposition to the institution of slavery. And he thought, if my own brother, my own flesh and blood, can be duped into these arguments in favor of slavery, then how many other people are walking around without any understanding of what this institution truly is and how evil it truly is? So he wrote a series of public letters. He didn't mail it to him directly. He published them in the paper and mailed his brother the paper.
This guy's a libertarian, isn't he?
Yeah.
I'm not going to talk to you directly. I'm going to make a public statement against you.
Exactly. It took off. Many people that had read The Castigator, that was the name of the paper.
Definitely a libertarian. That's I should have named that my blog. I'm changing the name of this podcast to the podcast The Castigator.
And he reached out, and after a series of several letters that stretched from August up to February is when the series ended, he tried to come up with every single possible argument that he could muster against slavery. And in doing so, he created essentially like the Federalist Papers of abolitionism. And
so,
this.
So let's pause there if you don't mind.
Yeah.
Let's set the table a little bit.
Yeah.
Because I think you hear, oh, this guy wrote some letters in a newspaper. And we think, okay. Because our modern conception is that you write a letter to the editor, it gets published, and nobody reads it, or maybe they read your Substack. And I put that up on Facebook, and my aunt's now mad at me because I said this thing. There's not really a cost, right? Mm-hmm. Compared to when and where and why he was writing and the level. We all, oh, this is the most divided we've ever been. No, this guy was almost murdered by his townspeople in the North because he said we shouldn't own people and black people are human beings, right? So let's talk about the North, because I think there is this conception that if you are in Indiana, like I am, mm-hmm. or Ohio, where Rankin was, or I think you're in Kentucky, which is guilty and evil. Right. But I think in Indiana, we have this notion that somehow this was just a safe space for black people who are running from slavery. And it was just those evil Southern states and slaveholders. But what was Ohio in 1820, and what was it like for a John Rankin who believed what he believed?
Really, the Western frontier, which is what Ohio and Indiana and Kentucky, all of those were considered very much the frontier at the time, or very recently former frontier areas. It was popping up where you had several cities and the Indian Wars were starting to push out further west. So you had more people moving over the mountains from your Virginias and your Massachusetts into your Ohios and your Kentuckys. But you still had a very like rough and rugged type of person who would live on the frontier.
The type of person who in 1821 moves to Indianapolis, which did not exist, and saws down 100-foot trees to build their house. And in the 6 months that it takes them to build their house, they're living under a stump. Like literally, yeah, that's the kind of conditions. And also it's a swamp, and also everything wants to eat you. And it can't be understated, I don't think, how Ohio, Indiana, Wisconsin, Indianapolis did not exist in 1820. It was just a very Spartan existence. It wasn't anything like we think of it now.
Yeah, so you had that really roughneck kind of person that the frontier tended to attract.
The person who had gone bankrupt in the East, or the person who was running from the law?
Not necessarily your high society people that would come over. Of course, there were some exceptions, Lexington being a notable exception to that, where you had a lot of the aristocratic types of people looking to, maybe they were a small fish in a big pond in Virginia, but they were a big fish in a small pond in Kentucky. There's a lot of history and backstory to all of that, but that is generally the type of person that was moving their way out west to Ohio and Indiana. But also you had something that I really try to emphasize in the book is slavery had a death grip on America in a way that I think it's very difficult for us to understand today. The slave system itself, you have like certain slaveholders who had various opinions, but the political system, in essence, went back to support and secure and preserve the slaveocracy. And any time that you had any threats to that slave system, that's where you often had conflicts. That's where you had mobs pop up in the North and the South. That's where you had free speech and free press threatened throughout the Jacksonian era with the abolitionists, something that John Rankin became very accustomed to in his day. So you had all these facets of society where liberty was threatened everywhere. The obvious place was clearly in the rights of the slave, but it did not end there. It threatened everyone and everything who said that slavery was a heinous institution.
Would it be fair to say that the closest thing that the modern mind could grasp is abortion's very, people on either side feel the other side is very immoral, and there's really like a stalemate on it, and it's very entrenched in the political system and very hard to change? Or the level of frenzy around shots and COVID and that like 2020, 2021 mindset of don't even talk about this. Or the lead up to the Iraq war was very much like that. I think we've had a couple periods where it was, is that a good way to relate it for people who don't quite know the history? Was it more intense?
It's a good place to start, maybe, how people get so riled up over these issues of abortion or COVID or something like that. Now,
but I guess we're not trying to kill each other over it. What'd you say?
I said dial that up by about 11, and that's, you're getting close to the way people felt.
I guess I didn't think of it till you and I started talking about this, and Levi Coffin was a very famous stop on the Underground Railroad here in Indiana. And I just always assumed Indiana were the good guys, but right. Indiana, most of the settlement came south to north, not east to west. And so you had, Indiana had a very southern, and Ohio too, especially where Rankin was. But I started thinking about, like, why was Coffin hiding slaves who were on the Underground Railroad? And why did he do all this in secret? And then I realized it's because everyone in town would literally kill him if they found out what he was doing. It's not like I'm going to unfriend you on Facebook for having the wrong opinion about abortion or COVID. It's, we're literally going to have the mob that the right threatens exists come and gang you because you are helping Black people to freedom.
Yeah. And there were a variety of reasons that a lot of people took those positions. Some people, it was very like they lived in a free state and they didn't necessarily own slaves, but they were racist. And they did not want to have multicultural society or a Black society or anything remotely close to that. Others were more concerned about having an invasion of slave catchers coming into their communities and disturbing their peace. And they saw the conductors threatening that peace and inviting these slave catchers into their communities, welcoming war in a sense. So there's a variety of reasons why these abolitionists were so hated by so many different people, some more legitimate than others. But I think it's hard for us to grasp in our modern context because nothing really compares to it. No political issue, even something as truly moralistic as something like abortion, which might be the closest thing. Even that is it's not quite in the same caliber.
There's a lot of bad stuff that goes on, but I don't think the level of depravity that was slavery exists in our society, right? Like it's, and by equal measure, the conscience that evokes in people who do have a conscience about such a system, which Rankin did. So in 1820, does he, Where did this develop? How did that conscience and that backbone to then speak out about this develop, culminating in 1820 when he writes these letters?
Yeah, so I mentioned a little bit earlier that he was a Presbyterian. I think it's often overlooked or underemphasized how much ministers played a role in the abolition of slavery. We look at it as a political issue, but this really stemmed out of the Second Great Awakening. Rankin was born in Tennessee. When he was coming up from Tennessee to move up to Ohio, he stayed in Kentucky for 4 years. And he was a byproduct of the Second Great Awakening, where you saw this great excitement sweeping through the frontier at the time, a religious revival sweeping through the frontier at the time. And it went a long way into kind of informing not just his own understanding of religion, but his own understanding of what people can do without a strong background or a strong moral center with what it what they might be able to turn it into if it's just like raw emotionalism or something along those lines. There was a real power behind that was gripping a lot of people. And that concerned him a bit. He thought if you can get people on emotion and can get them into something without having that strong theological backbone, then you can get scripture to say almost anything you want it to say, including that scripture supports the institution of slavery. And that was something that I think had a really strong influence on his upbringing. And that motivated him. Also, the kind of Calvinistic notion of God's plan and fulfilling that destiny for your life. He came to the realization that his plan for his life was to see that slavery was to be abolished. After his brother died in the War of 1812, he came to a realization that this was his sign, that he meant to go out and actually defeat it.
Yeah, so he was raised in the South, right? Did he have personal interactions that kind of informed? Because one thing I've heard is that, like in the North, right, there's a lot of ignorance around slavery. So they just bought that this was good for slaves. This was good for people who were in fear and couldn't take care of themselves. And then when the Civil War happened, Indiana soldiers, for instance, would go down and actually fight the war and write back home saying, you have no idea how depraved and awful this is, immoral. And the people at home reading the letter would think that they had been they'd become woke. They'd just been listening to the wrong people. How I can't believe that Lincoln has tainted their mind with this, until they got home and they were like, no, this is really horrible. And that's what changed it, was the Civil War, when soldiers who were indifferent then had a personal experience with it. So what was his background that led him to see this is a great moral evil?
Slavery was ever present in the South. Fortunately for Rankin, it was not nearly as much of an influence in the society that he grew up in Eastern Tennessee. There was a lot of anti-slavery pockets throughout that part of the country. So he didn't have to see too much of it, but he obviously witnessed its influence nonetheless. And especially whenever he started preaching, one of his first few messages that he preached on, he didn't call out slavery directly, but he did preach against all forms of oppression. And people could read between the lines of what that meant. And it caused the deacons in his church to pull him aside and say, you can't preach about that anymore. We have slave owners in our church.
We might lose donations, Caleb.
Yeah. And his convictions kind of stem from that faith. And finally led him to decide that if he's going to do this, which he knew that he needed to, then he's going to have to go somewhere that is free soil.
Okay, so he goes, and does he like become an abolition activist right away? Or is it really when he gets the news about his brother that he's activated and then starts to make this more of a mission? Or was he just...
He's always outspoken.
Okay.
He never tries to shy away from it. In fact, in Kentucky, he got into a little bit of trouble. This is what kind of prompted him to complete his journey to Ohio, is because he started preaching to slaves in the area.
Uh-oh.
And it got into a little bit of trouble because, of course, he wasn't one to necessarily sugarcoat his message in any way. And once he realized that he was preaching an unadulterated version of the gospel instead of one that kind of doesn't really highlight sort of the freedom aspects of what the Bible has, then they got pretty upset with that, and he completed his journey as a result of that. But he was first and foremost a minister, but he was never really trying to become an activist or anything like that. He was just telling the truth as he saw it, and that generated a lot of like-minded individuals to find some inspiration from this. And then whenever his brother finally told him that he had purchased slaves, then all of these people, it took a little while, a few years before it finally caught on. But you have a lot of people who would point to his letters and say, this is the comprehensive understanding of what immediate abolitionism is for this country.
Yeah. And so I guess the way that you describe it in a piece that I read that I'll link is that this was like the Federalist Papers for the abolitionist movement, that he did it in a very, almost like in a way of like Christian apologetics of, okay, what is your, all right, you have this doubt, let me write to answer that doubt. Okay, so you believe this, let me go and give you an apologetic for why that's wrong, like almost countering it. And then that had the effect of what?
I think that's a really good description as well. I compared it to the Federalist Papers because that gave birth to or at least helped pave the way for the adoption of the Constitution. In a similar fashion, these letters paved the way for the American Anti-Slavery Society, because one of the individuals who found his letters and in his hands and was consuming it was William Lloyd Garrison. At the time, he was still a proponent of colonization, the idea that if we are to achieve any sort of emancipation, there has to be a deportation phase to the process, shipping former slaves to either Africa or the West Indies or in the American West, because otherwise there's going to be some sort of race war. That was something that Garrison... I don't want to misconstrue it, because Garrison was always sympathetic to the issues that slaves faced, but he was young at the time and it was difficult for him to process things. So to him, colonization looked like the best path forward. And then Rankin's letters fell into his hands, and he was already leaning in this direction, but this kind of solidified it. It put into words the things that he knew to be true in a way that he didn't know was possible, basically. And ever since that moment, Garrison considers Rankin to be his anti-slavery father, is what he calls him, or he considers himself to be a disciple of John Rankin's. And this has a direct through line to the creation of the American Anti-Slavery Society and the Liberator, the abolitionist paper. And the American Anti-Slavery Society actually uses Rankin's letters as a sort of textbook to teach and to inform newcomers, and as they are lecturing across the country about abolition, they're using Rankin's arguments and they're using his letters to inform the public about what makes slavery so wrong and why abolition needs to be immediate.
But he faces a lot of opposition, does he not?
He does. And even from abolitionists, even from Garrison himself, which is
when you take that that index card of allowable opinion and you light it on fire, Caleb, it gets murky.
Yeah, I think this is an area that a lot of libertarians may chuckle at when they read the book, because it is very similar to what we might be familiar with. But Garrison became an adopter of what became known as Garrisonianism, which is there is no acceptable participation in the political process for abolitionists, that the political process is married to slavery, so it is immoral for abolitionists to participate into it. This was not a view that John Rankin had, and this is one area that he differed pretty strongly with him on. Rankin adopted more of the constitutional abolitionist view that there is a process that we can use. It's a constitutional process. Now, he wasn't necessarily like a constitutional scholar or anything like that, but he did believe that these splinterings that Garrison was leading the abolitionist movement through, it was coming at the detriment of the slave themselves. Because as you dig your moral boots into the ground, the slave is the victim because he's the one that's still in bondage. He's the one that's still in slavery. So he wanted, Rankin, that is, wanted the best and quickest pass forward without having to compromise any particular principles. And he saw there were various schemes that he thought could be an avenue, but predominantly, he thought constitutionally, it is what it needed to be.
So the book actually, does it go out of print after its first printing, partially due to mobs lighting the warehouse on fire and other things?
Yeah, so he sells about 600 copies. And then there was an incident of arson in the warehouse that a lot of the copies, there were about 1,000 copies that were printed for the first edition. And he just thinks that's that. And at least his piece is said, and at least his brother did divorce himself from slavery after that. So that was the primary object of the letters, and anything more to come of that was just icing on the cake. But there were some Quakers in New Jersey that got their hands on the first edition that eventually gave it to William Lloyd Garrison, and then that breathed new life into it. And this took about 4 years, you have to think, and he wrote his letters in 1824, 1825. It wasn't until about 1829, 1830 that these things really caught on. And that kind of reinforced his belief that this is something that he's destined to do. He's meant to do. He's called to do. And that caused him to double down in his efforts.
So before we move on in his story, what were some of the arguments that he was refuting? Like, what are a couple things that like he saw as tent poles of why slavery should continue that he attacked?
Yeah, I think the most prominent argument that, or at least the one that he found the most passion in, was the idea that slavery was God ordained or sanctioned by scriptures. And the phrase that he uses in his letters that I think sums up his viewpoint is that scripture is one grand scheme of benevolence, that it is meant to treat all people as if they're equal in the eyes of God. And of course, you can get into the specifics and the nitty gritty about what slavery looked like in the Bible versus what it looked like in the American context. And that's very different. But ultimately, that's, if you could sum up his understanding of what that looks like in one sentence, it would be that scripture was one grand scheme of benevolence.
So moving on in his story, we're running a little low on time, but when Lloyd Garrison breathes new life into all of this, how does he spend the remaining years? Does he become an activist? Does he become a speaker like Frederick Douglass was? Like, what does he do to help coalesce this movement?
He was right there at the beginning for the American Anti-Slavery Society. He did go around and hit the circuit, speaking to mostly in Ohio, where he's based out of. But he was traveling all over the place. He was going to anti-slavery conventions in New York and Philadelphia. And of course, anywhere that he went, especially in Ohio, the mobs were never too far behind him, ready to pelt him with rocks and eggs. And a couple of instances, he would have his horse kind of sheared and maned and have his mane removed and his tail bobbed. Just really cruel things would come of it, to the point where he had to park his horse on the other end of town so that they wouldn't touch it. He had a lot of grit. There, a lot of these things, which this is something that I think the New England abolitionists a little bit, was because they were in New England, so they didn't really have to, as what you were alluding to earlier, they didn't really see slavery at its face, so they could stand up and you have your garrisons grandstanding morally on occasion. But Rankin only went as far as he needed to away from the South. He understood what issues Southerners dealt with. He was a very compassionate man in that sense, but he also understood that slavery was morally detrimental to America as a society and to the slave owner himself. And he was concerned with both the safety and security of the slave and the freedom of the slave, as well as the soul of the slave owner. And that was something that he wanted to continue to do, regardless of whatever the risk was. And there's plenty.
Which I think is a great lesson, because, and that echoes a little bit of Martin Luther King Jr. and the Birmingham letter, for the segregationist and the segregated are both equally harmed by segregation.
Yeah.
Which is, I think we find in our own time, like a brave stand to go, I care about the soul of the person I oppose.
Yeah.
I think that's one, that's a wonderful lesson. What are some other lessons that you learned about Rankin that are evoked in the book?
Rankin, I compare him to a George Washington type figure and the context of the American abolitionist movement. He was someone who, George Washington at the time in the 1790s, he was someone who brought the country together at a time when they needed a unifier more than ever. And Rankin fills that role, I think, in the history of the abolitionist movement. So I think that leadership and that sense of unity and sense of clarity, while also not forsaking any of the, it's not to say that you have to compromise on your principles per se, because he certainly never did that. But he did bring all the factions of the abolitionist movement together, because he understood that slavery was the enemy. It's not us. And the more that we splinter and the more that we fracture, the more ground that they're going to have.
All right. So obviously we want to help you. And I know that pre-ordering on something like Amazon helps a lot. The book comes out when?
It comes out this October 15th is the release date. If you pre-order now, the pre-ordering on Amazon is what's going to help the book the most, because the more that it shows that people are interested in the book, the more it's going to get it in front of new eyes as people are searching for similar types of books. Go out and pre-order the book. I promise it's a really great story, and that will hopefully help get Rankin's story in front of more people and more eyes.
Yeah, and if you'd love to, if you have a book club or if you have a group that Caleb could come speak at, then obviously reach out to him too. We want to help support our own. Very proud of you. It's a great accomplishment. You text Caleb and 3 weeks later, he'd be like, I've been in a cave just writing about it. It's, writing a book has to be really hard. I can barely write a blog.
Yeah, it's, you get into a flow with it. It's very intimidating at first, but after I got finished, I almost forgot how to write an op-ed of 600 to 800 words, because
which you writing, you need to do, because you work for Young Voices, right?
Yeah, it's something that you have to work a different muscle in your brain to make it concise, as opposed to just elaborate as long as possible. But it's a lot of fun, especially when you have a rich story and a rich subject, which fortunately I was able to have.
All right, so we'll put in the show notes the pre-order link. Please go help Caleb out. That really helps him. And congratulations. And if people want to follow you, how do they do that? Shameless self-promotion time.
You can follow me on Twitter or X, if you so choose to go that route, at Caleb Franz, just my name. And then, of course, on Amazon, it's called The Conductor, The Story of John Rankin, Abolitionism's Essential Founding Father. That is currently available for pre-order.
All right, Caleb, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks, Chris.